All right, everybody, we're going to begin our program now, so please sit down if you're not already sitting down, and feel free to continue eating if you're not finished with your lunch as we begin the program. I am John Hinderacher. I'm president of Center of the American Experiment, and it gives me great, great pleasure to welcome once again to an American Experiment Lunch Forum, Heather McDonald. Heather is the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She is a contributing editor of City Journal. She was the winner in 2005 of the Bradley Prize. She's the best-selling author of The War on Cops. And some of you, I'm sure, were here 2 years ago when we had a fantastic lunch forum where Heather talked about that book, The War on Cops. We had 150 law enforcement officers representing more than 40 agencies around the state of Minnesota. It was a great event. And Heather is also the author of her most recent book, The Diversity Delusion, which provides the material for her speech today. She also has an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal. So if you are a Wall Street Journal reader, do take a look at the editorial section. You'll find Heather's op-ed there. Most of all, however, Heather is a courageous warrior in the cause of sanity. Please welcome Heather McDonald.
Well, thank you so much. It's an incredible honor to be back at the Center for the American Experiment. If any of you don't support the center, I urge you to do so. I can tell you from experience that I don't know any other think tank that gets as much media coverage for its activities as the center does. I know donors are always interested in metrics, measuring efficacy, impact, and the Strib, against its own inclinations, has to cover what they do because it's so important. So this is, if you want bang from your buck, this is a way to do it. And thank you for that very generous introduction, John. I'm going to speak about our current travails, and I hope maybe in the question period to get some suggestions for answers. The increasingly desperate search for racism in America has come to this: sneakers. Earlier this year, Adidas released a sleek white running shoe with a Black Pride logo on its insole as part of its Black History Month collection. Social media exploded. A white shoe, it seems, is now an endorsement of white supremacy. And so Adidas penitently pulled the shoe from stores and issued an apology for failing to, quote, properly recognize and honor Black History Month. Anti-racism has become the religion of key American institutions, whether in the corporate world, academia, or the media. The only problem is cases of actual racism are becoming ever more elusive. You therefore have to get creative. Footwear took a particular beating this year. Pop singer Katy Perry brought out a line of women's flats in 9 different colors. Each had an identical design of lips, eyes, and a triangle nose on the top of the shoe. Perry was forced to atone for her racial sins and withdraw the entire collection from stores because the racism police saw in one shoe the ghost of blackface. Never mind that the stylized facial features were identical on each color shoe and were clearly conceived independently of any pairing with a black background. Perry grovingly apologized for, quote, inflicting pain. Now, what it means to be a civil rights crusader has also changed as actual racism becomes harder and harder to find. Filmmaker Spike Lee recently issued a stirring call to arms. Quote, I, Spike Lee, of sound mind and body, will no longer, wait for it, wear Prada or Gucci until they hire some black designers, end quote. This was not a joke. If a black filmmaker whose métier is telling whites that they are bigots ordinarily subsists on luxury consumer goods, we are arguably in a different universe than the one that gave rise to the NAACP. But Prada and Gucci had introduced clothing accessories that to the racism police conjured up another purely imaginary echo of blackface. And so these companies had to apologize for their racism and pull a wool sweater and a handbag accessory from circulation. Now, if this unending search for phantom white bigotry confined itself to shoes and sweaters, we could laugh it off and go about our business. Unfortunately, it is claiming real victims and doing real damage to civil society. As you will recall, a tsunami of hatred crashed down upon a group of schoolboys from Covington, Kentucky in January because a doctored video showed one of the students, a smile frozen on his face, looking a Native American activist in the eye as the activist banged on a drum and chanted inches away from the hapless student. The media and the Democratic political class let out a glad cry. Here, at last, was ocular proof of American racism. Mirabile dictu, the boy was even wearing a MAGA hat. The boy was, quote, the smiling face of whiteness, declared a University of Pennsylvania education professor. Whiteness, she added, that, quote, harms and maims and kills. Celebrity guru Reza Aslan asked, quote, have you ever seen a more punchable face? New York Times columnist Charles Blow declared that the MAGA hat was the new iconography of white supremacy. And after someone got around to actually viewing the full video, which demolished the entire narrative about white male aggression towards people of color, the liberal establishment remained unchastened, ready for the next phony incident to supply it with still desperately needed corroboration for its favorite trope about patriarchal white supremacy. And that next fabrication was quick in coming. The black actor Jesse Smollett correctly bet that the political and media elites would deliriously welcome an absurd tale about his victimization by MAGA supporters at 2 a.m. in sub-freezing Chicago, because when it comes to white perpetrated hate crimes, the demand for examples of such hate is bottomless, but the supply is woefully thin. Now, what is behind this frenzied drive to find spectral white racism? A corrupt academic culture that has leapt out of the ivory tower and is fast remaking the world in its image. That culture is dedicated to three propositions that I've called the diversity delusion. First, that the most important thing about an individual is his sex and race. Second, that discrimination based on those characteristics is the core feature of the United States in particular and of Western civilization in general. And third, that any lack of proportional representation of so-called people of color or females in any institution is by definition the result of discrimination. Business and nonprofit leaders would rather accuse their own organizations of bigotry than acknowledge the academic skills gaps, behavioral and cultural differences, and different career preferences that account for racial and gender disparities in the workplace and elsewhere. The diversity delusion is engulfing every aspect of American life. The Brett Kavanaugh witch hunt imported campus rape ideology into the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Black Lives Matter movement is a street version of the academic idea that America's criminal justice system is lethally racist. The Democratic presidential race is awash in what is called on campus, quote, intersectionality, with each candidate trying to tick off as many identity-based boxes in the victim sweepstakes as possible, whether being female, gay, black, Hispanic, or Cherokee. And even the rebuilding of the Notre Dame Cathedral has been subjected to identity politics. Some professors in the US and Canada are worried that trying to recreate the lost spire would privilege a, quote, white European France. Honoring the magnificent legacy of the West is incompatible with multiculturalism, it would seem, by the left's own admission. So let's take a brief tour of where these corrosive ideas begin. America's universities. In a word, colleges are in the grips of a mass hysteria. Students actually believe that they are at risk of their lives from circumambient racism and sexism. The degree of maudlin caterwauling is impossible to overstate. At Brown, students of color met with the president and demanded exemption from such ordinary academic expectations as going to class and studying for exams because they said they were so focused on, quote, staying alive at Brown. At Yale, a mob of minority students surrounded a respected sociologist and screamed at him for 2 hours because his wife had suggested that students can choose their own Halloween costumes, free from the ministrations of Yale's discrimination watchdogs. Among the shouts of shut the F up and you are disgusting that were directed at this mild-mannered left-wing professor was a cry of we're dying, referring to the allegedly endangered status of Yale's minority students. Now, my dinner companions last night from the center asked that I include this latest outburst of such hysteria. This from last week at Williams College, a very small, elite college in Massachusetts. Following the lead of the Congressional Democrats, my dinner companions last night asked for the unredacted version, assuring me that the Minnesota audience, however nice and well-meaning people are, were ready for some pretty salty language. So here goes. This is a student speaking at the student council, furious because the council did not instantaneously grant a request for funding for a black-themed, potentially blacks-only event on campus. Here's part of his response. It's time for y'all to figure this shit out and check yourself because I'm really losing it. We are fucking tired of having to come and beg and suck dick. And of course, when we come and do, we face problems all the fucking time. Every time to be here is like sucking white dick every fucking day, closing our mouths every fucking day just to be here. And if we dare ask for a little bit of time, money, and space, we gotta suck some more dick. It is so frustrating. It is so tiring to be here to deal with you all. Okay. We know what's going to happen to that student. He'll get his funding, and it'll end there. There will not be a single word of rebuke. But my favorite moment in this parade of narcissism comes from Princeton. In 2015, Princeton's black students chanted, "We're sick and tired of being sick and tired." This was a phrase first used by Fannie Lou Hamer, a civil rights activist who was beaten in the 1950s for trying to vote. Fannie Lou Hamer had grounds aplenty to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. But any Princeton student who thinks of himself as oppressed is in the grips of a terrible delusion that will encumber him for the rest of his life. Perhaps you are thinking, well, at least the adults on campus are trying to give students a firmer grip on reality. Wrong. A massive diversity bureaucracy is devoted to cultivating in students ever more arcane species of self-involvement and ever more preposterous forms of self-pity. Students regularly act out little psychodramas of oppression before an appreciative audience of diversity deanlets and vice provosts of equity, diversity, and inclusion who use the occasion to expand their dominion. If you want to know why tuition is so obscenely expensive, look no further than these multiplying diversity sinecures. Many campuses have created bias response teams, modeled presumably on active shooter response teams on the assumption that discrimination is so rampant and lethal on campus that a rapid defense force is needed. Freshman orientations and dorm sessions feature seminars in toxic masculinity and white privilege. Students are taught that they are either the oppressed or the oppressors. If you are not female, black, Hispanic, gay, or any of the 116 and still metastasizing categories of gender, the only way you can escape being an oppressor is by becoming a, quote, ally. Now, allies are something we usually associate with war. And indeed, the reigning thinking is that females and students of color are in a war zone on college campuses and need allies from the opposing side to survive. Am I exaggerating? I am not. UC Berkeley's Division of Equity and Inclusion hung banners throughout campus reminding students of the university's paramount mission, assigning guilt and innocence in the ruthlessly competitive totem pole of victimhood. One banner featured a female black student and an Hispanic male student allegedly pleading, quote, allow people other than yourself to exist, a message directed to Berkeley's white students and faculty. The diversity bureaucracy aspires to total control. Here at the University of Minnesota, diversocrats posted flyers in all dormitory bathrooms reminding students about their white privilege. You can't even answer the call of nature, in other words, without being harangued. College presidents are among the worst enablers of victimology. After the expletive-filled tirade directed against the Yale sociologist, Yale's president, Peter Salovey, actually thanked the student thugs for making him so proud of his student body. And Yale subsequently conferred a racial justice prize on two of the most aggressive participants. The dean of the Harvard Medical School recently removed the portraits of its greatest physician scientists from the entrance hall to one of its teaching hospitals. You can guess the reason. They were all male. And thus looking on them would make Harvard's wilting medical students feel uncomfortable and unsafe. We can only wish these budding doctors luck in the operating room. The faculty are equally complicitous. A math professor at Vanderbilt University argues that mathematics is a, quote, white and heteronormatively privileged masculinized space. They're teaching this stuff, folks. Hobart and Williams College offers a course in white mythologies which posits that objectivity and meritocracy are smokescreens for slavery and the subjugation of women. Similar curricular enormities are ubiquitous. Identity politics has destroyed the serious pursuit of knowledge throughout the humanities and most of the social sciences. Students are being given a license for ignorance. All they need to know about a book is the gonads and melanin content of its author, to know whether they can dismiss it as thoroughly repugnant and not worth reading. Shakespeare, Milton, Chaucer, Plato, Kant, Locke, and Mill have been variously defenestrated by students who have not the slightest clue about Periclean Athens, the Renaissance, or the Enlightenment. A Columbia undergraduate groused about Columbia's beleaguered core curriculum, quote, who is this Mozart, this Haydn, these superior white men, she said. The core, quote, upholds the premises of white supremacy and racism. Few professors have defended our intellectual patrimony against such shameful outbreaks of ecstatic know-nothingism without adding some puling qualification about respect for diversity. And now, every non-academic institution, no matter how previously meritocratic, is also in the crosshairs, and that means, above all, the STEM fields. Exhibit A in our culture's descent into identity-driven mediocrity is the firing of Google engineer James Damore in August 2017. Damore had written a carefully reasoned, fact-based memo suggesting that the average career preferences of males and females may explain why there is not 50-50 gender parity at Google and other tech firms. The language that Google CEO used in firing Mr. Damore was a direct import from academic victimology. Google's employees were, quote, hurting, he said, because Damore had dared to challenge the reigning orthodoxy. What followed Mr. Damore's firing was even more disturbing. A regional branch of the National Labor Relations Board upheld Google's actions on the same grounds. Mr. Damore's memo had made Google's employees feel, quote, unsafe at work, according to the NLRB Associate General Counsel. It thus constituted, quote, discrimination and harassment. Consider for a moment what this NLRB ruling means for science. Any evolutionary biologist, psychologist, or economist who studies the different risk preferences and appetite for competition among males and females is vulnerable. Those branches of science could shut down completely, no matter that their findings are true. The mad rage for gender and racial proportionality in the workplace is accelerating, especially in the Me Too era. From here on out, everything you read, everything you watch in the mainstream media will have been calculated in conformity with the demands of diversity. Newsrooms are under enormous pressure to find reporters, select sources, and originate stories that improve their diversity profile. Book publishers are obsessively scrutinizing their lists for diverse authors and themes. Thanks to media pressure and their own human resources departments, corporate boardrooms have made a fetish of gender proportionality. Case in point, Drew Gilpin Faust, the outgoing president of Harvard University, recently accepted a position on Goldman Sachs' board. Well, who knew that left-wing American history professors knew anything about investment banking? If you are a white male in any field, no matter how talented, you're going to have to meet a higher standard to get hired or promoted. If you have a white male son, and he is neither gay nor trans, woe unto him. Last summer, California Polytechnic University proudly announced that it was successfully reducing the number of white students whom it enrolled. Other colleges are not as forthright about their intentions, but they are all involved in the same enterprise. A respected Midwestern evangelical college has virtually stopped admitting white males into its graduate programs because it knows that they will have such a hard time getting a teaching job, and the college doesn't want to hurt its placement statistics. At Microsoft, like virtually every other big firm in the country today, managers get bonuses if they don't hire and promote white men. Has anyone heard of Mannels? Okay, well, listen up, because this is another signpost of the future. A Mannel is a panel of experts consisting almost exclusively of males. Mannels are now verboten in woke society, no matter if the male panelists at an Alzheimer's conference, say, represent the most cutting-edge scientists in the field. Last year, a professor at the University of California, Davis, demanded that every male scheduled for an upcoming conference on microbes resign and that the conference sponsors withdraw their support since the invited presenters were heavily male. The lineup, miraculously, changed immediately to a near majority of females. The University of California at San Diego proudly announced last month that it had invited only females for a biology conference. Fannels, you see, are not just okay, they are glorious. Were the UC San Diego Fannelists best researchers in the field? Who cares? Even classical music is being poisoned by identity politics. New Yorker music critic Alex Ross triggered outrage last spring against the Chicago Symphony and Philadelphia Symphony Orchestras because they had programmed no female composers in their upcoming season. Never mind that at that very moment, the Chicago Symphony was at New York's Carnegie Hall performing Jennifer Higdon's Concerto for the Low Brass, a work commissioned by the Chicago Symphony and Philadelphia Symphony Orchestras, undoubtedly at greatly inflated cost. It is absurd to expect gender parity in the concert hall. The reality is this. The greatest composers of all time, whether Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Chopin, or Brahms, were all male. Get over it. Who cares? Let's just be grateful for the beauty they gave us unworthy mortals. But classical music boards are also under enormous pressure to hire by gender and race for conducting positions and everything else. A classical music agent told me wistfully, "If only I had a trans conductor, I'd be rich." Now, it is an unalloyed pleasure that Hollywood is being forced to sacrifice its best box office judgment to meet the demands of the race and gender bean counters. But it is in the sciences where the diversity imperative becomes most momentous. Every academic science department, whether physics, mathematics, or chemistry, is at risk. The federal government is demanding that scientific departments hire based on gender, race, and sexual orientation rather than scientific merit. University administrators are ordering faculty search committees to tear up their short lists for hiring and reconfigure those lists to include more females, regardless of qualifications. Science education is being slowed down and watered down in the hope of graduating more females and underrepresented minorities. An oncologist at an Ivy League medical school was berated by his dean for giving an exam in pharmacology that was too, quote, fact-based. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going for chemotherapy, I want my doctor to know the facts about drug interactions. The National Science Foundation is doling out millions of your taxpayer dollars to study alleged microaggressions and heteronormativity in engineering and math, arguing that discrimination against so-called diverse scientists is pervasive and that only so-called diverse labs can achieve scientific breakthroughs. Well, that's funny because somehow the 200 National Science Foundation grantees who won Nobel Prizes managed to discover such things as dark matter and the genetics of viruses without conforming to today's diversity metrics. And of course, this mania for gender and race parity in science continues into the private sector. After James Damore was fired, a human resources manager sued YouTube and Google for firing him because he had refused to go along with the mandate to interview only females, blacks, and Hispanics for entry-level engineering jobs. Potentially groundbreaking scientists are being passed over today because they are of the wrong race or gender. Guess who does not care about diversity metrics? China. The best thing that Donald Trump could do to level the playing field would be to airlift a few cargo planes of gender theorists from American universities and dump them on Beijing University and its research labs. Get rid of them. But until that happens, China will inexorably pull out of ahead, since in science at least, it seems to care only about one thing, scientific accomplishment. Academic identity politics is tearing our society apart. It is teaching young people to hate the greatest thinkers and creators of the past, and to hate their fellow Americans, as you heard most vividly from the Williams student. The consequences may not be confined to a culture war alone. The diversity delusion, therefore, has to be explicitly challenged. The next time self-engrossed students occupy a campus building demanding more reparations, here is what their college president should say. Are you kidding me? You are the most privileged individuals in human history. You have at your fingertips the thing that Faust sold his soul for, knowledge. You are surrounded by libraries that would have driven the Renaissance humanists mad with envy and desire. You can read every book that has ever been written. You have access to scientific laboratories that are the most advanced in the world. You can pursue languages, literature, and history. Everything is available. Far from discriminating against females and minorities in hiring, every faculty search here is one desperate effort at finding remotely qualified, underrepresented, and female candidates who have not already been snapped up by better endowed schools. Far from discriminating against underrepresented minorities in admissions, we employ double standards in order to engineer so-called diversity. I can assure you that my faculty are not bigots. They have nothing but goodwill for history's oppressed groups and want all of their students to succeed. At this very moment, millions of Asian students abroad are studying night and day for the privilege of experiencing this alleged maelstrom of hatred. If you feel so oppressed, step aside and let them take your place. It's obvious, right? Simple truth. But a college president never says any of those things, of course. Instead, he is silent before these outbreaks of mania, happy to sell out his faculty as alleged racists, and promising to make further amends for so mistreating the oppressed students. It becomes imperative, therefore, for the rest of us to rebut the victimology narrative. It is not enough to call for freedom of expression. That is, if I may borrow a term, a relatively safe stance to take, even if you liberals will black you up. No, if we're going to restore sanity and civil harmony, we're going to have to take on the victimology narrative directly and assert that for all our historical flaws, and they were real, there has never been a more tolerant, opportunity-filled polity than the present one. The constant delegitimation of American institutions undermines the normative basis for law and order. The U.S. has been immune from the tribal anarchy that is still common in other parts of the world. But if we continue down this path, Antifa violence, the threatening confrontations directed against conservative public figures as they go about their private lives, the sucker punching of Trump supporters, and worse, will become the new norm. A new path will mean reclaiming the university, since the preservation of freedom requires knowledge of how unique has been the West development of the rule of law, the scientific method, and the concept of individual rights. But a university's highest calling is to convey the full glory of the Western inheritance, to inspire students to get down on their knees in gratitude rather than raising their fists in protest, to help them grasp the beauty, wit, and profundity of a vast and rich tradition, one to be discovered, if you will permit me, a selective and idiosyncratic list in the works of Aeschylus, Rabelais, Tiepolo, Twain, and yes, at the risk of student complaint, Mozart. Thank you for your attention.
We've got time for questions and answers. In keeping with the American Experiment tradition, Peter Zeller has the microphone. If you want to ask a question, just raise your hand.
When I get to you, please stand and identify yourself.
Thanks for coming to the best city in America, Heather, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Thank you.
If you had a daughter or a son graduating from Minneapolis Roosevelt High School down the block where I went to school, what college would Mother Heather McDonald say, Here's where I want you to go to school. Would Hillsdale be one? Not advertising for Hillsdale, but where would Mother Heather McDonald send her daughter or son to school today?
I think I would have to bone up and do some homeschooling. Really, I mean, that is the next step. I say this with great reluctance because I am so reluctant to pull the plug on the university because I do believe it has this glorious, there's no better job in the world than being a college professor. No better job. They have been given the privilege of curating these great works. And when we stop teaching them, they die. And that responsibility is on our shoulders. And yet, as I travel around to schools, I see not only this diversity poison, which again, it is coming to get you. I don't want to sound apocalyptic, but don't think this stuff is merely funny. It's very serious, and it is going to absolutely transform our society. But not only is there the diversity poison, there's also just complete inanity, complete lack of learning. So short of homeschooling, there are the few counterexamples. Obviously, Hillsdale is strongly committed to the great books. I've heard about the University of Dallas, which also has a very strong core curriculum, St. John's schools that have a quirky core curriculum. But it's very tough. And the thing is, parents, it turns out, are not so interested, sadly, in what their students actually learn, their children actually learn. The credentializing magnet is just overpowering. And it is hard to forswear the power of stamping your child's forehead with some elite university's diploma, because we all use those diplomas and affiliations as a sorting device, as an IQ spotting device. So if we could maybe give everybody IQ tests and then use those as a surrogate, but right now that's what's going on. But it's a very difficult question. And again, there's nobody who believes more fervently in what universities should be than me. But I'm reaching the conclusion that they are virtually irredeemable.
Hi, my name is Dave Winkle, and I'm from Bloomington. I can't get understand what the word means. Transparency. Can't they just say openness? Transparency. They always say it in different languages.
Your question is, why can't we use the word openness instead of transparency? Right. In what context?
Well, they always, in the news media, they always talk about being transparent.
I don't see them as a hugely consequential choice. But what we do need is transparency in college admissions. I'll tell you what is driving a lot of this bizarre claims of dying on college campuses from racism. This is all being driven, on the race side at least, by racial preferences. This is the most perverse policy that a college could come up with. It works fabulously for the diversity bureaucracy because it creates students who are angry, who are hostile, who feel victimized, because there's not a single selective school that is not admitting their vast majority of so-called underrepresented students, which is blacks and Hispanics, with about a standard deviation of difference in academic skills. Now, of course, there are individual students who have been admitted on their merit, but they labor under the stigma of being a preference hire. And all of your, if you have kids in senior year in high school, they all know this. It's everybody knows the SAT gap to get into selective schools, and yet these schools pretend that it isn't happening, and they guard their admissions data as if it was, the nuclear code or something. We saw this with the recent lawsuit against Harvard to get at its anti-Asian preferences. I mean, it's Asians who are being screwed the most by these preferences for blacks and Hispanics, to be an Asian, you know, a academic score that would give an Asian applicant at Harvard only a 25% chance of admission would give a black applicant a 95% chance of admission. And Harvard has the least degree of preferences of any school. But currently, it has a 14% black student body in the undergraduate. Without racial preferences, the number of black undergraduates at Harvard would be less than 1%. So that shows you the degree of preferences. As you go down the academic ladder, schools have to dig deeper and deeper into the applicant pool. This is a pernicious policy that is driving the victimology. And as long as it remains in place, and I can guarantee you that the schools are desperate to preserve it in place because it makes them feel like they're dispensing noblesse oblige and that they're superior to you red state rednecks out here that they believe are racist, when in fact there's never been a more well-meaning, less racist group than Americans who are so ready to be post-racial. You know, nobody gives a damn. This idea that Republicans say are racist, I've observed one love affair after another on the part of conservative voters with black politicians. They don't give a damn about their skin. What they care about are their ideas and policies and support for bourgeois culture. So please don't tell me that we're living with structural racism. Yes.
Oh, hi. Hi. He doesn't want to give over the mic, which is probably really smart. My name's Michelle.
Hi.
And Michelle Tafoya. And one of the things that I did, I'm a graduate of UC Berkeley,
uh-huh.
although my husband tells me I can no longer say that because I sent my diploma back. I was furious with everything that's going.
Good for
so
you.
So I sent it back.
Interesting.
They wrote me a letter saying, that must have been such a painful decision. And I said, no, not really. It really wasn't. I mean, as far as I can see, I don't need a diploma anymore anyway. So I think that's a good step to take to sort of wake up the administrators a little bit. But my head's about to explode, and I'm just wondering what, on a daily basis, what an average person can do, a little step here or there that can make us feel like we're fighting the good fight.
Yeah, I sympathize with your desire for an action plan, and I'm going to give you the end point, and, you know, I'm more of a critic than an activist, so I'm sure there's plenty of activists in the room who can think of strategies. All I can tell you is this. As long as the left's narrative about racism and sexism is the only allowable explanation for any disparities in employment, for the fact that there aren't, 50-50 females in high-tech firms, or there's not racial proportionality in law firms or banks, as long as the unchallenged narrative goes that that is due to racism and sexism, the left wins. We can talk about free speech all we want on campus. It's not going to make a darn bit of difference. So what I know needs to happen is that more people need to stand up, more police chiefs need to stand up and say, the reason for our patterns of policing is not race, it's crime. More heads of corporations need to stand up and say, we are trying to hire, we over-hire minorities and females. But there is a skills gap, there's an academic skills gap in this country. The average black 12th grader reads at the level of the average white 8th grader. Again, there's many exceptions. There's many exceptions. Obviously, there's hundreds of thousands of white students who are standard deviations below black students. There are thousands of black students who are at the top of their classes. But on average, this is a difference that is massive, and it explains our reality. And so everybody is cowed to talk about it, because to speak the truth about these skills gaps is to put a large target on your body saying, call me a racist. But unless that narrative is punctured, we continue to go down this path. So if you're in any condition in your environment to give statistics that explain lack of racial and gender proportionality, to talk about, I mean, what's behind this insane trans mania? It came out of nowhere. It's the weirdest aspect of our time. And I ask myself, what's behind it? I think that even though the trans movement takes its victims from females by stripping them of their accomplishments, it is actually driven, it's a feminist crusade to deny the difference between males and females, that there's any reality, that there's, you know, that there's anything real between male sex and female sex, so that they can go on to continue arguing that there should be gender proportionality. So people that know the truth, you have to start speaking up. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Zara Haidari. I am a senior student at Liberty Classical Academy. I'm writing a thesis about same-sex marriage. And my primary research question is same-sex marriage beneficial for society or not?
Is same-sex marriage what?
Beneficial for society or not. And I am taking the side, the con side for it, and say no, same-sex marriage is more harmful than beneficial. And I have been in discussion with people outside of school about this topic, same-sex marriage, and I have been asking them this question: do you think same-sex marriage is beneficial for society? And they don't have any answer for me. Like, they are just so, like, so most of the people that I have been talking, they just tell me that my question is not good or is not loving. And whenever I'm trying to challenge them with my arguments, they don't listen to me. Mm-hmm. And they are just saying that, no, the question is not loving, and they're trying to talk about the civil rights and the loving relationship. And my friends and I, we have been really challenging time. Is a problem for us, and we don't know how to talk to them while they don't listen. And what is your response to, like, what is your recommendation to us? What is your recommendation for me? Or what is your response to those people who do not talk about it?
Yeah, well, you're very brave, because that's, I mean, it just, as a student, to be in an environment or a faculty member where you're challenging the orthodoxies takes a lot of courage, because they control the discourse. And I'm surprised you say they call you just not loving. What they're probably also calling you is hate. I mean, notice, keep an eye out for this mechanism of the left. They will label anything they disagree with as hate. If you say anything that doesn't conform, it comes from hate, as opposed to a simple disagreement on the facts. It's the word hate now is unbelievably capacious. I will give you honestly my view of this, and I'm not sure if this is useful to you in your context. I was unwilling to sign on to a petition by a guy, David Blankenhorn, who had been one of the main defenders of traditional two-parent marriage for decades, and he flipped, and he said, this battle is lost. Let's just say that what matters to kids is the rule of two. That what matters is they have two parents. It doesn't matter if they're same-sex parents. There's no hope in trying to defend any longer the traditional two-parent family. And a lot of my colleagues on the right signed this. I wouldn't. I didn't, because I predicted, and I've lived this experience myself, that the normalization, for me, what's most crucial is same, not same, so much same-sex marriage as same-sex procreation. It makes it impossible to say that children, on average, need mothers and fathers. That men and women are different, They're complementary. They bring different skills to bear in raising children. That if to say that now, to say children need mothers and fathers, is to invite being accused of homophobia. And it's true. I was at the Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and I was talking about the policing, and I was asked about policing, and I was asked by some ed school professor, well, you know, what sort of programs are you in favor of, for heaven's sakes, to alleviate inner city poverty if you're not a, don't think that government welfare can do it? And I had the temerity to talk about the Boy Scouts as a code of goodness for young boys. In the absence of fathers, the Boy Scouts gives them an ethic of male chivalry, nobility, self-restraint, self-discipline. But I said, ideally, it's a family. It's the mothers and fathers. And immediately, what came at me was, you homophobe, white supremacist, racist, Islamophobe, you name it, everything, you know, class privilege. But the main thing was the homophobic. It's a complicated answer to the fact that it makes we are already at the point, thanks to feminism, that maintains that strong women can do it all. I mean, feminism is the real enemy of the two-parent biological family because it is out to disappear males. And so to say that the strong mothers, however, there's many that are succeeding against the odds with the best of intentions, but the odds are really against them. Again, if there's single mothers in this audience, I am not meaning to single you out, and you may be doing a fabulous job, but the data, the social science data, is absolutely clear. The children growing up without their fathers are at huge risk of juvenile delinquency, prison, gang involvement, you name it. So that's my main concern with gay marriage, and above all, the idea that gay child rearing is utterly indistinguishable in its social consequences from the traditional two-parent family. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Natalie Gross. I'm a student at St. Catherine University. And my question for you is, how would you recommend navigating an all-women's university where the transgender community, the women identifying as men, are taking advantage of the all-women space? For example, we can't send an email that says, hey, ladies, or post on Facebook, hey, ladies, because it's not inclusive.
Yeah.
At an all-women's university.
Well, with the ladies bit, so that's because... But weren't the men, like, I'm still not completely up to speed on the trans thing, like, which way it goes. So you presumably, and I'm not allowed to say this, but in this environment, you have biological males who are now identifying. You have...
We have females, born as females, identifying as men on our campus. That's all women's.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, no, it's really delicious. I mean, if one could separate oneself from the larger context here, it's really great that the feminists are being so screwed by this. And you have women's schools like Wellesley that are twisting themselves into knots of how you deal with the trans. And by and large, the males are winning. You know, they're accepting males. It turns out that if you're biologically male but identify as female, you're the status symbol on campus. And of course, we have the other delicious aspect of biological males stripping females of their sports records. We've spent 3 decades now with Title IX destroying male sports on campus so that we could have lots of places for females to be strong females together. And now you have males walking in and walking off with the track record that will never be broken. A female will never meet this. So from here on in, no females get to be track winners. So I don't know. I think on this one, I would sort of let it play out and let them eat each other up. It's really fun, except for the fact that the long term, I credit the feminists on this because They are taking short-term hits in the service of a longer-term goal. They are thinking strategically for the long-term, and the longer-term goal is to completely eviscerate the concept of the difference between men and women.
Peter, let's take one more question.
Hi, my name is Earlene McCauley, a.k.a. Mac, like macaroni and cheese.
Okay, Mac.
But there's Yum. Always this part of the conversation that is not included, no matter where I go, no matter who I listen to. And that is abortion in the black community. Right now, the black population is at 13%. The abortion rate is at 48%. So these people can scream about racism all they want. The politicians, especially the black politicians, Hollywood, but our race is being lost. And something has to get out. Honesty, truth. This young lady was talking about the homosexuals or whatever. You have to chip away at this stuff a little bit at a time. You can't not come at them full force. One of the things that in our community, in the black community, is the celebration of Black History Month. I don't celebrate it anymore, because what are we celebrating? When our ancestors are the slaves, they fought to stay alive. They fought to stay alive. And now we've become so sophisticated and so modern that black women are killing their own babies. That is nothing to celebrate. In New York City recently, Cuomo, they lit up the towers with pink. And 2 or 3 years ago, more black babies were aborted than were born. It was over 20,000 babies gone. So these people that are running around yelling about racism, mm-hmm. they need to stop and take a look at who really is the racist.
Yeah. Thank you for that statement. It is a very bizarre thing, the fetish for abortion being treated as a positive good, rather than in some cases perhaps a tragic necessity, perhaps. I mean, but it is actually celebrated as almost an accomplishment. So that's, again, something that needs understanding about what is it in modern feminism that is again, I would say it's an attempt to destroy any idea that females have something specific that they contribute, which is child rearing. And it's the neutering of the female body and of the difference between males and females. I would add another aspect of black self-immolation that is also not allowed to be talked about, which is simply street crime. The blacks die of homicide in this country at 6 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. That is a civil rights problem. And they're not being killed by cops, they're not being killed by whites, they're being killed by other blacks. And there's just a terror to speak about the cultural breakdown in inner city neighborhoods that is leading both to that the astronomical crime rates. Blacks commit homicide at 8 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. And if you take Hispanics out of that picture, you have a black-white homicide differential of about 11 or 12 to 1. That is massive. It's exponential. People are just not willing to talk about that. But it is incumbent, I think, on those good... I write about the police as well, and all I know is that there are so many thousands of law-abiding, bourgeois, good residents of inner-city communities who understand the value of the police, who understand the value of families, and the media needs to start listening to those voices rather than just the Al Sharptons. Thank you.
Heather McDonald, thank you. Thank you very much. A couple... A couple of quick announcements before we end our program. First of all, the center's annual dinner is going to be Saturday, May 18. And as most of you, I'm sure, know, we have now lined up Candace Owens as our featured speaker. I referred to Heather earlier as a warrior in the cause of sanity. Candace Owens is in the same category. She is, in my opinion, by far the most important person of her generation, maybe the most important person in America, and among other distinctions, she'll be by far the youngest annual dinner speaker we've ever had here at the center. So I would really encourage you to sign up for that event, buy a table, buy a ticket, buy a couple of tickets. Seating is prioritized by date of purchase, so if you buy your ticket today, you will lock in that priority. That's Saturday, May 18. I think it's going to be a great event. I don't know how many of you saw Candace Owens' testimony before a House committee a week or two ago. It was absolutely nuclear, and it's going to be an exciting evening, and I hope you all can come. Second announcement. Say it again. It's going to be here. It's going to be here at the Hilton. It's Saturday evening, May 18. And if you go to our website, americanexperiment.org, you get all the details. You can sign up online, and it will also give you the phone number of Perry Cariaga, who is the person, if you prefer to do it by phone instead of online, Perry is the person to call. Last announcement, Heather is going to be signing books right now at the conclusion of our program. We've got a bunch of copies of The Diversity Delusion on the table just right outside the door, and Heather's going to be signing them. And today we have a special offer. That is, for only $50, you get both a signed copy of The Diversity Delusion and either a new or renewed membership in Center of the American Experiment. So I hope you'll take advantage of that offer. And with that, our program is concluded. Thank you very much.